Good afternoon. I'm Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform, if I could say it. Excuse me. And on behalf of the Alliance, our chairman, Jay Rockefeller, our co-chair, Susan Collins, and the other members of our board, I want to welcome you to a briefing on the health policy topic that gets more attention than any other this spring, I guess, and that is getting affordable, high-quality health insurance to low-income children. Now, our partner today in this briefing is the Commonwealth Fund, which has a long-standing interest in this subject. You'll hear from Ann Gauthier from the fund in just a moment. Now, today we're going to look at both whether young Americans have health coverage and also what kind of health care that coverage gets them. And I suppose a subsidiary topic would be how their actual health is affected, which, of course, is the ultimate goal. Not only do we have an outstanding panel of speakers to help us examining the topic, we have the assistance of the March-April issue of Health Affairs, which, if you have not picked up a copy, you ought to. It focuses specifically on children's health in its many aspects, and we want to thank Health Affairs and John Iglehart and his staff and the folks who supported that issue for making copies of this issue available to everyone here today. I mentioned that the Commonwealth Fund is co-sponsoring this event, and representing the fund today and sharing moderator duties is the senior policy director of the fund's Commission on a High Performance Health System, Ann Gauthier. Ann?
Thanks, Ed. Welcome, everyone. We are delighted to co-sponsor this briefing today, and I'm personally delighted to co-moderate with the master. But I've been given the job of quickly setting the stage for those of you who may not yet be as familiar with this program, and if you aren't yet, you certainly will be, because this is what you'll be dealing with quite a bit this year. The SCHIP program was born 10 years ago, hence it's time for renewal this year. It was adopted as part of the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 to provide health insurance coverage to low-income children up to age 19 under 200% of the federal poverty level. But for states that had already been covering kids up to that age group, up to that poverty level, they were allowed to expand up to 50 percentage points higher than their Medicaid eligibility. States may develop their SCHIP programs in three basic ways, or they could develop back then. They could make choices. In a moment, I'll show you a picture of how that happened. But they could either expand their Medicaid program, or they could develop alternative standalone programs, or they could create a program that was a combination of both Medicaid and SCHIP. SCHIP is financed by both the federal and state governments. Currently, about 70% of the dollars come from the federal government and 30% from the states, and it's administered by the states. Within federal guidelines, states have a great deal of flexibility. They can determine specific program design, eligibility categories, benefits, provider payments, and a variety of operating and administrative procedures. There was a strong incentive for states to take up the federal government on this opportunity. States receive an enhanced federal matching rate that exceeds their Medicaid match by about 30%, with the federal share capped at 85%. And just two quick pictures, you see that states did take a variety of approaches. Remember that the three options they had was really a compromise between those who wanted this program to be an entitlement and those who wanted it to be a block grant with a cap. So in 2006, we have 11 states in the District of Columbia that have Medicaid-based SCHIP programs. We have 18 that have separate programs, and 21 states have a combination of the two to form what my friend Alan Weil said recently is quite the patchwork quilt. And there's just as much variation, but perhaps a little bit less, in terms of the income eligibility levels for the children's separate programs. And you see in 2006, we had 28 states that were at 200% of the federal poverty level. We have 8 that where the eligibility is lower, and we have 15 where the eligibility is higher. We're going to cover a variety of the critical issues today that you'll be facing in terms of the reauthorization, and we'll start first with the financing of the SCHIP program by turning to Jean. Should I kick it back to you, Ed, first, or should we go on? I think are we ready?
I think our panel is distinguished enough that we ought to say a couple of words about the panel. Obviously, we're not going to do them justice. We refer you to the material, the biographical material in the kits for further information. But Jean Lambrew is indeed our first speaker. She's an associate professor at George Washington and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and has held senior positions at OMB in the White House. She's also the author of the excellent issue brief about SCHIP in your packets that was prepared for January's retreat for members of Congress that was sponsored by the Alliance and Commonwealth. Then we're going to hear from Nina Ocherenko, who's a senior healthcare policy analyst for the Heritage Foundation. There are two of her monographs about today's topic in your materials. Nina served on Hill staffs for 3 different members of Congress over the course of a decade. Sarah Rosenbaum will follow Nina. She's chair of George Washington's Department of Health Policy and a Hearst professor there. She's an attorney by training, author of more articles and studies on health law and policy than most of us have ever read. And Debbie Chang will bat cleanup. She's senior vice president and executive director of Nemours Health and Prevention Services in Delaware. She actually ran the Medicaid and SCHIP programs in Maryland for a while. She led the initial implementation of SCHIP nationally and spent a number of years right here in the Senate as a senior legislative staffer. So we're very pleased to have a distinguished group to help us through this broad list of issues. And as Ann said, we're going to start with Jean Lambrew. Jean?
Thank you, Ed, and thank you all for coming. We're actually going to try to, in this panel, really dig deep into several of the major issues that are likely to be confronted this year in Congress, and probably the most immediate issue, and potentially the one that we'll be dealing with in the most difficult ways, is financing. What I'm going to try to do in 10 minutes is really cover 3 big areas of financing for the state children's health insurance program. The state allocation, meaning how much each state gets from a fixed amount that's in legislation. Second is talk about that actual amount that will be contemplated to put into legislation, because that federal amount or cap matters. And third, the state share of SCHIP funding, because how much states have to pay determines how much they're willing to expand coverage. But to start with, basically the way that SCHIP works today is that there's a number in law, and that number for this year is $5 billion, and it gets divided up across all states and the territories. The current formula divides up that money in an initial allocation based on 2 different factors. One is called the state cost factor. The other is called the number of children. The state cost factor is nothing much more than a wage index to account for geographic differences in prices, whereas the number of children is composed of both the number of low-income uninsured children in a state as well as the overall number of low-income children in a state. So the money is allocated across states using these very simple factors. If a state has actually 3 years to use that allocation, and if it doesn't use that funding, it reverts to be reallocated to states that need it. So they keep that money for 3 years, and then it's redistributed to what are called shortfall states, states that don't have enough money to cover their current needs. Pretty simple, straightforward approach to how we allocate this money. But the problems have been in this past 10-year period, first of all, some conceptual problems. What we've seen in some states that have been very successful at expanding coverage is that they've actually reduced the proportion of low-income uninsured kids. So the more you expand, the less need you have, but the less money you get, so the greater problems you have. So there's some conceptual flaws in the program, as well as this issue of taking away money to states you give it to. So say that we give the funding to a state, it spends a year or two trying to spend it, doesn't spend it. Is that money that state's money, or should it be reallocated to other states for low-income children who need it? These are conceptual issues that have come up in the past 10 years. We've also some measurement issues. I won't get into this in detail now, but the data source has some issues with it. The current population survey doesn't have a lot of sample in certain states. There are time lags with the data, and there are also kind of questions of what is a shortfall state. These are all kind of formula allocation issues that we've experienced in the past 10 years. How do we know we've experienced them? Well, if you look at this chart, what is showing you in the green bars is states' actual spend, the percent of the state's spending as their allotment. So a state that got exactly enough money will get 100%. And we only see that about 9 states had within plus or minus 10% enough money in its allotment for its needs. States basically had either too much allotment or too little, and we see that we've not done a good job of spreading that money across the states. So in the next couple months, we're going to see a lot of options for new ways of allocating this money. Some would, focus on this initial allocation. Maybe we actually blend in actual enrollment experience in each state into how much the money the state gets. We could base some of that funding on historical spending. Why not, for a state that's been successful, give them some sort of percent allocation that's based on their success? Or maybe we should be looking at new data sources, either state-based data sources or improving our federal data sources, so we can do a better job at targeting that money. Another set of ideas would say, okay, well, maybe if we can't necessarily get it right the first time, let's work on that redistribution. Let's shorten the amount of time that a state can spend this money, going from maybe 3 years to 1 year, as the administration would recommend. Some people are considering 2 years in legislation. Maybe we do rules on who gets that money when it gets redistributed. And I really can't say that word, and I apologize for that. Redistributed? I'm not sure how to say it. But anyway, there might be rules about how you get that money back to states to really try to say, how do you make a more perfect block grant, which is what these types of ideas do. But all these state allocation issues matter to the extent that there's enough money in the system. This chart is talking about the federal money, because SCHIP is a cap program. There's a number written into law that says how much we're going to spend. And what that red line on this chart is showing you how much was written into law. It was about $4.2 billion for the first 2 years of the program, went down due to budget constraints, and in 2007 is about $5 billion. But with no changes this year, Congressional Budget Office assumes that it'll continue at that dotted line of about $5 billion a year. The problem is that program costs are growing. Both the number of children eligible for the program, enrolled in the program, healthcare cost growth, medical intensity, all these things continue to march up over time. So what you see in that orangish bar is what is the amount of federal funding that will be needed to maintain the current programs that we have today. And if you add that all up, it's about $13.4 billion over the next 5 years, not counting two important things. 2007, where we have some shortfalls, we're about short $700 million, according to CBO, in 2007. And there's also kind of some Medicaid interactions that are not counted in this chart. So we basically have a problem in terms of our federal funding cap. Even if, though, we were able to get that kind of wedge that I just showed you on that chart, there's this other kind of issue out there, which is there's a lot of children who are eligible but not enrolled in that program, in the programs. We know that SCHIP covers about 4 million kids at a point in time, anywhere from 6 to 7 million at any point during the year. A significant percentage and number of children are eligible but unenrolled, and that ranges from about 2 to 3 million for SCHIP to 3 to 4 million for Medicaid. And if we were to try to, on top of that wedge I just showed you, cover some of those eligible but uninsured kids, some rules of thumb are it could cost about $8 billion over 5 years to cover a couple million kids in CHIP, and another $12 billion to cover a couple million kids in Medicaid. So we really do have, on top of the numbers I just showed you, this other issue, which is how do we get funding for those kids who are not covered today? What this chart shows is taking kind of that estimate from CBO of about $8 billion to cover 2 million kids in CHIP and overlays it on that orange wedge to say, if there were no federal funding limit in SCHIP today, roughly this is what the program would cost from a federal perspective, about $50 billion over 5 years, not counting Medicaid. It's important to recognize that anytime we do outreach, we get children in Medicaid, and this chart doesn't show this. So if we had no cap, this is what the program would look like. So now we have to figure out, what is the cap we put into law? There are three basic options for what we could do. One is we put a high cap in. We put a number in here, and what you can see in this red bar is a pretty high bar, beginning at about $10 billion and going up to about $14 billion a year. Why put in a high bar? Well, remember that reallocation and allocation formula issue I was talking about earlier? If we're not good at getting money from the federal government to the right states, we have to build in a cushion. Otherwise, states are not going to have enough money to get all these eligible but unenrolled kids as well as the kids in the baseline. This does put less pressure on your allocation formula, but it does have the political downside of a pretty high bar right there. Option two is that you basically try to put the dollars that are in legislation as close to what you think you need as possible. That kind of is good fiscal policy because you're trying to put in only the allocation here begins at about $8 billion and goes to about $12 billion in that red line. The challenge is you have to do a very good job of getting that federal amount to the states that need it. This is no easy task. If you've looked at that earlier chart where we show where state spending is, it really does vary, and it's not going to be easy to define a formula that would get there. You need lots of kind of allocation rules associated with it, but it has a top line that's close to what we need. And the last thing that Congress could do is kind of set a low bar, set a low cap. In this case, that red line, which is the federal allotment, begins at about $7.5 billion and goes up to about $10 billion. And again, that sounds, it's called the low bar, but that's in 2012, twice the level we have today. The challenge is we are either leaving children who are eligible but unenrolled out of the system because there's not enough money to get all those children, or you could do proposals like we saw in the bipartisan Healthy Kids Act that tries to get at enrollment adjustments, so we come in after the fact to try to compensate states through performance bonuses or other means to kind of fill in that gap. And we could talk about this a little bit more in the details. But it is going to be a challenge to figure out how we allocate or figure out what federal dollars to put into law. Now, there's a third financing issue that we have to face, because let's say we figured out how to allocate the money and figured out what to put in federal law. We also have to encourage states to spend money, because even if we got a high federal allotment, some states would not or could not spend that money. So there are some options that Congress could consider. It could increase the federal share of spending if states do certain things, like continuous eligibility or meet performance targets. It could blend the Medicaid and CHIP matching rates so over time that they're the same. So there's also different options that could be considered to encourage states to spend irrespective of the federal dollars. But I want to close by saying that I've been talking a lot about numbers, a lot about federal costs. I do think we have to remember that when we're looking at all these numbers, we are just looking at one fraction of the costs that are out there. Whenever we increase federal costs, we're decreasing family costs in the form of reducing waiting lists that have proven to be problems for families. We're helping businesses because sick children typically grow into be sicker or poorer workers as adults. And lastly, we have a societal cost because we know that children who are uninsured don't use the right and appropriate care. They potentially are not learning to their potential, and we know that it hurts their child development, as we'll hear from our other speakers later. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Nina?
Okay, thank you for having me. I'm going to kind of take a broader vision of children's health insurance beyond SCHIP itself and talk about health care coverage for children overall. First of all, I certainly agree that uninsured children versus children with coverage, there's a big distinction. And while uninsured children are still the smallest portion of the uninsured, except for those 65 and older, they're the smallest portion of uninsured, that's still a very important issue for Congress to address and for policymakers to look at. Because the implication, as Gene already pointed out, are drastic. The uninsured children, in particular, tend to get care at a very inefficient and costly manner. And I think that's important for all policymakers to remember that this is not something that we should be encouraging, that children don't have health care coverage as they're in society. And as was pointed out also, we see some access issues that reflect this. We know already that 25% of uninsured children have no usual place of care compared to children with coverage. That's public or private coverage, and I think that's very important to stress that these are children who really don't have a medical home or a place to go when they get sick. That's why we see increasing number of uninsured in the emergency rooms, overcrowding, and crowding out services that really need to be taken place in the emergency rooms. The second is actually something from a conservative perspective that I like to stress, which is there is a cost to taxpayers. Sometimes people say, well, we really shouldn't worry about the uninsured. I mean, they're getting care. It's not the greatest, but there aren't people dying in the streets of America, and they're getting care in some form or fashion. But I would say that it's a very important issue because the cost to providing that care in an inefficient system is costing taxpayers at the end of the day. And as taxpayers, we certainly should be concerned about people that don't have health care coverage. And there are some estimates back in 2004 that had about $34 billion in federal, state, and local funding that was spent on uncompensated care for the uninsured as a whole. And I think that's important to stress and a reason why policymakers should come together at looking at options for providing coverage to children. I now want to kind of talk a little bit about what's the interaction between public coverage and private coverage for children. I think this is an important place, in particular in discussing SCHIP, which tends to focus on working low-income families. So these are not the poorest of the poor. These aren't children below 100% of poverty who have no other options. These are children and families who usually have a working parent or predominantly have a working parent involved, et cetera. So what is this interaction of public coverage and private coverage? We hear a lot about children being eligible for public coverage but not enrolled. But the flip side of that is also, well, why are they not enrolled? What are the other options out there? What are the effects of continuing to expand and enroll children in the public programs? What's that impact on the private market itself? And we know that there was a recent reanalysis that was done on the crowd-out phenomenon where, you know, what is the crowd-out effect of expanding public programs in the private market and dealing with the uninsured? And they did recognize, this is Jonathan Gruber and his colleague, did state that there was a tremendous crowd-out effect, somewhere around 60% crowd-out effect of public program expansions since SCHIP. And I think that's important to note, as well as that these are that the implications are stronger when you look at the entire family. And that's what really we're talking about as well. It's not kids as individuals, but we want to look at the interaction of public coverage for the child and the interaction of that with private coverage for the family. So in saying that, I want to talk a little bit about private sector and kind of quality of care that children can get in the private sector. There's a lot of talk about, well, SCHIP, if it's for children, that must be the only vehicle there is for children to get health insurance. And I would argue that there is a private market that is working that children can participate in and probably could get coverage in as well if we look to broader than just looking at building on SCHIP in its current form. The private sector still does today provide better access to care than it does for those in public coverage, and certainly better than those that are uninsured. I think that's important to note. And it's also important to note that public programs tend to sometimes promise more than they can deliver. We do know that now today doctors are seeing fewer, pediatric doctors and Medicaid are seeing fewer Medicaid patients than they did in previous years. That should be an issue of concern for children. How do you get access? You qualify for coverage. It says you have coverage, but who's going to see you? Who's actually going to provide that coverage to you? I think that's an important issue to think about. There are quality initiatives. Some of the discussion we're talking today is about quality of care and what kind of quality initiatives are out there. I want to touch on a couple in the private sector, actually, that are going on, that are existing today, because the private sector itself, through markets and through consumer demand, can actually improve access and quality as well to children. Employer-based coverage is probably the number one area that people think about the most when they think about private health insurance and how do we get health care coverage. Still, the majority of Americans, well over 60%, get their health insurance through the place of work. So it's interesting to kind of take a look and see what's going on in the employer-based market that is focused on improving quality for care for children as well as their families. And I'm going to touch on a couple. First of all, the LeapFrog initiative. This is something that's been underway for a long time. It's purchasers of health insurance kind of joining together and starting to encourage and reward providers for increasing quality. They have a big hospital rating system that they do. This is valuable information, and actually people who are purchasing the products in the private market joining together and trying to say, how can we make healthcare better quality and better for the consumers and better for the people we're purchasing the coverage for? So I think that's an important piece. Bridges to Excellence is another type of a quality initiative that was underway. It's a coalition of purchasers as well as physicians, other folks in the healthcare industry and the healthcare sectors teaming together to say, how do we move forward on improving quality of care that's involved in the healthcare system? And finally, what we have seen most recently is the administration's initiative at HHS called Values-Driven Healthcare Initiatives. It's based in a kind of a four cornerstones of policy issues for the private sector. It's not a mandate. It's simply how do we look and encourage the private markets and encourage the private sector to help with improving the quality of care that is delivered in our system. Talks about establishing health records, medical health records, something that would be very important for children, especially if they're in and out of healthcare systems. Gives them one place to have their information held over their lifetime, which I think is there's great value in that. Measuring, publishing, actually quality data. That's a very interesting piece and a very important piece, especially when you team it up with the third piece, which talks about reporting quality and price and on pricing information. Teaming quality and price is probably the most dramatic tool that consumers have, parents will have for their children in deciding how best to get care and services. It's not just who's the lowest price, you know, let's see how low we can make a physician take a payment. But the idea is, how do we increase the quality, too? I mean, we see this in any other area of the market where when you have competition, you have increased consumer demand for better quality. And those are the things we should want to demand out of the healthcare system. And then the final thing that within the values-driven healthcare is creating positive incentives for the consumers themselves, rewarding good behavior. If you take your child to get their immunization shots, what can the private sector do and what are the private models that we can look at to reward that type of good behavior? Those are some of these four cornerstones, I believe are things that can also help within the public program. So they're not exclusive to the private sector, but there's a great deal of information and a great deal of momentum in the private sector that can be reviewed and used in the public programs as well. So it's not exclusive. So there are a lot of good lessons in there. Non-employer-based coverage. It's still a small portion. There's still a very small amount of people and families actually buying coverage on their own, meaning outside the place of work, but buying private health insurance. But there has been some analysis done on, well, what are they buying? And is it really health care coverage? We hear a lot about, well, gosh, they're high deductible plans. You don't have access to anything. Who's actually going to use them? Actually, you find that it's a broad cross-section of people. They have PPOs. People are purchasing HMOs. There are a variety of choices that are out there, and consumers themselves look at the idea of what's price and the quality that's going to be provided that help them decide what to choose. I point out that some of the survey by America's Health Insurance Plan found that actually of the HMOs that people purchased, 100% of them covered well baby care. That's important information to know, I think. When you think about what are people buying, they're not buying, you know, the complete stripped down package of nothing there, no coverage at all. These are policies that include preventative medicine as well, and I think that's important to stress. So where does this put us in the whole debate on CHIP coverage and what to do next? My stress is that there's a way maybe to find ways of coordinating public and private coverage together to make it more useful for the consumers themselves, more useful for children. How do we look at expanding options for these families so it's not either you put your child in SCHIP and I remain uninsured, or I'll join an employer-based policy but leave my kid in SCHIP? How do you integrate these two models to make it work more seamlessly? And I think ideas such as expanding on the premium assistance models that some of the states have used in SCHIP, expanding it, which allows the families to take a subsidy from SCHIP and help pay for the private coverage that they purchase. Currently, it's really defined just as the premium. I would go further and say that those funds should be able to be set aside for the child to use for not only the premiums, but any cost-sharing requirements. So let's say you do have an employer-based policy. What's the problem? Well, maybe the cost-sharing is too much. Maybe the deductible is too much. If you take the subsidy from the SCHIP program, that may help alleviate some of those holes that may exist in the current system. So I think that there is a lot of opportunity of looking to expand the relationship between the existing SCHIP program as well as the private coverage options that some families may prefer to use.
Thank you, Nina. Sarah, would like to hear your views on this.
Thank you. First, my bank in my credit issue in Michigan Island. I made the title stuff. Can you hear me out there? Is this projecting? My task on this panel is actually to talk to you a little bit about the issue that lies just below the surface of what Gene covered and to some degree what Nina covered, which is the design of the program itself. What kinds of benefits, what kinds of services do children receive under SHIP, and how the SHIP benefit design relates to the Medicaid benefit design, which is essentially encapsulated in a benefit known as early and periodic screening, diagnostic, and treatment services, EPSDT. And I've started with the floor, Medicaid. If you think about the relationship between Medicaid and SHIP, Medicaid is the floor. It covers, as of course Gene's slides show you, the great majority of low-income children who get direct government public finance through federal programs. EPSDT is a mandatory benefit. It's required for all categorically needy children. For medically needy children, EPSDT is actually an option dating back to the early 1980s. This requirement of getting the full EPSDT benefit to children, actually all individuals if they're covered up to the age of 21 in states, does not change as a result of the Deficit Reduction Act, but I'm going to come back to that. If you look at the cost of the EPSDT benefit itself, it is actually a rather limited cost, which is very important when we get to the next slide on the difference between Medicaid benefit design and SHIP benefit design. EPSDT benefits are actually Medicaid benefits for children. This is from some work that Ann and I did for the Commonwealth Fund a couple of years ago. Comes in at about $1,300 compared to, you can see, of course, the costs, which are understandably much higher for people who have serious disabilities or who are frail and elderly. Children make up a minority of the high-cost users of Medicaid services. This, I believe, actually is some work from some work that Gene did earlier. But they are a significant proportion. There are a significant number of children who depend on public finance, who have very advanced health care needs, and they make up about 1 in 5 of all children who are considered high-cost to state Medicaid programs. Some interesting work coming out of a series of studies of children who get Medicaid and children who get their subsidies through SHIP programs, whether they're administered as Medicaid expansions or as separate programs, suggests that there really is no difference in terms of the health status of children who are financed through SHIP as opposed to children who are financed through Medicaid. They are all predominantly children who are low income. Low income children, of course, are more likely to have serious and significant health problems. This is our attempt to get onto one slide, something that actually typically involves much more writing, which is a sense of the differences and similarities between Medicaid and SHIP. The assumption on the SHIP column is that we're talking about states that are administering their benefits as a separate program. If a state uses its SHIP funds to expand Medicaid, which many states do in whole or in part, they are essentially providing what is known as EPSDT to their children. If they choose in whole or in part to set up a separate program, they are providing a SHIP benefit. The SHIP benefit in a separately administered state looks much more like what Nina was describing. That is, it's premium support into a private plan. States that are running separate SHIP programs run their programs almost entirely by purchasing coverage. They purchase coverage in the equivalent in an individual market for children. It doesn't necessarily get regulated as an individual insurance market, but they're buying private enrollment, by and large, into pediatric benefit plans. And SHIP is designed, when separately administered, to allow states to buy the equivalent of what would be a standard commercial product offering. That is the meaning of the benchmark. And so instead of EPSDT's emphasis on developmental early intervention for children who have risks for long-term health and developmental delays, what you see is a standard well-child benefit. Vision, dental, and hearing care are optional the way they are in the commercial market. the benefit design is tied to actuarial estimates with very, very limited requirements, really none of the defined benefit requirements one finds in Medicaid. Insurers are free to design a medical necessity standard and can, in fact, be more limiting than the kind of medical necessity standard used in Medicaid, which is an early ameliorative standard meant to ameliorate the effects of developmental conditions. Cost sharing in the old days of Medicaid was prohibited entirely. Now it's allowed to some degree. And, of course, in SHIP, when separately administered, it's permitted to some degree. The important shift in policy, which I want to draw your attention to, is the DRA. The DRA essentially creates a third way, and the effect of this third way is really only beginning to be understood in states, because states are only beginning to think about using DRA flexibility. What DRA essentially did was to import the benchmark language from SHIP into Medicaid for low-income children. However, the DRA also specifies that all EPSDT benefits remain a required feature of the program. And, of course, the DRA also broadens state options around cost sharing. So in an article that actually I did with Paul Wise for this issue of Health Affairs, what we have started to think about is the interactive effect of the DRA, EPSDT, and a SHIP benchmark. Essentially, where the DRA begins to move us is toward something that might be thought of as a tiered benefit for children. That is a standard commercial offering supplemented by the kinds of expanded services and benefits that one typically would get through EPSDT. Most of the children who need all of the EPSDT interventions are children with significant mental and developmental and physical health problems, exactly the children, actually, whom Senator Grassley helped with his expanded eligibility rule for children with private insurance but who have serious disabilities that was also part of the DRA. We actually have identified several issues that we think are the big issues in this SHIP-Medicaid interaction in the coming years, which will see states maybe rethinking how they align their child health financing to both emphasize where they want to a market intervention, which is actually just builds on what states do in managed care already under Medicaid, supplemented by a tiered benefit for children with serious health conditions. That would mean reframing the benefit as a benchmark plus a supplement, thinking hard about the role of the developmental assessment, which is absolutely crucial to EPSDT and would be part of a standard benefit plan for a child, potentially even in the commercial market. How to integrate the EPSDT medical necessity standard into commercial offerings, what's part of the benchmark, what's extra. And finally, creating what we call a developmental utilization management technique, as well as quality performance measures, to make sure that benefit design, however it's structured, is adequate for both healthy children and those with special needs.
Thanks, Sarah. We'll get you a pointer, Debbie, and then we'll be off to the races.
Can you hear me? Is this on? It looks on. Can you hear me? Okay. A little. What I'm going to do is really cover two areas. The first is that I'm going to talk about the fact that we need a system to really measure the quality of care. And by that, I really mean the performance of our child health system and its impact on children. It really should answer the question, are children getting what they need in terms of their overall health and development so they can reach optimal health and development? The second thing I'm going to talk about is the type of child health system they need. Because our kids need more than just an insurance card, more than just coverage. They really need a system that responds to their needs. So I'm really going to talk about the need for a prevention-oriented child health system. So I'm first going to talk about quality and data under SCHIP, and I want to make the point here that what I'm saying applies to our whole system. It's not just public coverage or a private coverage for children. It really applies to our whole system. We don't have a system for really measuring the performance of our health care system. So SCHIP in this sense is really an example of the successes and challenges. In terms of successes, if you look at general satisfaction on the left-hand side, surveys show that parents are generally satisfied with SCHIP. And also we know that attention has been focused on monitoring and tracking enrollment data. In addition, there's a voluntary system that CMS has that requests states to report on 4 performance measures. 2 are related, as you see in the chart, to well child visit. The third is the use of appropriate asthma medication. And the last is access to primary care practitioners. And again, this is a voluntary system on 4 measures. There's also data, and it's in your packet, that shows that it's a survey done by Vern Smith that shows that the vast majority of states are engaged in some type of performance measurement, because just as the federal government cares about accountability, states care about accountability as well. Now, some of the challenges are, with this voluntary system, most states report at least on 1 child measure, but no single measure was reported by all states. And there was a wide variation in reporting methodology. In addition, if you really want to look at the performance of the system, you need to have individual level enrollment data and claims data, and that will help in overall monitoring of the system. In addition, if you look at SCHIP, there's data that shows that enrollees' access to primary care is very good. Enrollees received more preventive services. They had fewer unmet needs. Actually, parents had greater peace of mind. Enrollees reported better access to and communication with providers. And one evaluation even found that enrollees had fewer asthma attacks after enrollment. But the challenges are that the children didn't receive the full range of preventive visits. And as with all public and private plans, responding to emerging threats like childhood obesity is a challenge. The other thing was, because of the lack of data, there's a real challenge in that we need additional data to look at the implications of program design features like benefit package and cost sharing on access to care. Now, so let me get then to the second point I wanted to make, which is, and I'll come back to this issue of quality. The second point I wanted to make is that we need to think more broadly about what our child health system and really being able to address the needs of children, and only then can we have a high impact on the quality of their care. And insurance coverage is just one step. If you look at those 3 steps, access to primary care, specialty care, that's the medical care that children get. But they also need prevention. And in addition, they need prevention and medical care integrated at the individual level, but they also need it integrated at the community level, because a child lives in a community. So that's the thing I'm going to focus on, is that prevention and medical care need to be integrated at the individual level and the community level. And that applies to where children live, learn, and play, at child care centers, primary care centers, schools, and the community. So what we really need is a system that promotes child health and well-being and development. And children are not just little people. They have unique needs, and they have health needs that span the lifetime. And if you look at this chart here, the child health and development over time, you see that there's a dark blue line there. And that dark blue line is the average trajectory of health care for children over time. And ultimately, I'm on slide 7. I'm not going through all the slides. Ultimately, we want a system that encourages optimal health and development. What we mean here is that we are encouraging the protective factors and reducing the risk factors. And if we can have a system that really encourages the protective factors, we can really deal with the optimal health and development for children. And so what this chart also shows is that over a period of time, there's a greater impact on children's health. It happens at the earlier age. As you can see, there's a steeper slope in terms of child development and health. And when I talk about the child, I really mean the whole child, because healthcare is just one piece of a child's development. When I talk about healthy child, I mean the balance of physical, emotional, cognitive, and social well-being. And you can see these different petals. They represent the different determinants of health, and healthcare is obviously a key determinant, but there's the community, there's the school. So it's the child's interaction with its environment, with his or her environment over time, that determines the child's full development. And so this really builds the case for prevention. And prevention can really improve child health in the short term as well as provide benefits into adulthood. And more our children are facing preventable chronic diseases that have their precursors in childhood. And the best example of that is child obesity, where the prevalence of child obesity has really been growing. And this applies to injuries and asthma, other preventable conditions. So if we can get at these chronic diseases or preventable conditions, we can really have an impact not only on a child's health, but also expenditures, because the 30% of chronic diseases that are prevalent in children account for between 70 to 90% of healthcare costs. So this is why prevention is such a critical part of our health system. And as this chart shows by Charlie Bruner, prevention is really linked to the overall healthy development for children. So if we really wanted to look at a prevention-oriented system, we would integrate both prevention and medical care together and also couple that with a community-based intervention. And that's what we've done at Nemours. We are an operating foundation which had primarily focused on clinical care, but now we're focusing on integrating prevention with medical care to get maximum impact for children. So ultimately, we want a prevention-oriented system that provides, on the left-hand side, the community supports. I'm on slide 15. Community services, prevention, specialty care, and ultimately treatment. But all these services are provided in a full continuum for children. So we're looking at a system that goes beyond the biomedical view of health to more of a multifaceted view of health, that goes from just acute episodic illness to focusing on chronic disease prevention and management, to go beyond focusing on individuals themselves to focusing on the community, to focus not only on the cure but on prevention, and then to focus on overall health and not just disease. So with that, I'm going to end with my two slides to bring it back to the system we need. We really need, whatever our system is in terms of health services, we need to evaluate the system and its impact on children. And what that means is we need a core set of indicators that should apply to all programs, and not just to children's programs, but to all programs. Because we don't have current benchmarks available, but we do need to develop those. Now, the IOM recommends a tracking system that looks at effectiveness, efficiency, accessibility, appropriateness, capability, safety, continuity, acceptability, and equity. And then the Commonwealth also has done some work on what you need for a high-performance system. And that looks at four general areas or a four-point framework. High-quality care, which includes prevention, access and equity for all, efficient care in terms of how it's delivered, and system and workforce innovation and improvement. Now, let me just close by saying that in terms of the system we need for child health, and one of the things I wanted to point out in this session was that I think we need four things. The first thing, I think, is an obvious statement, and perhaps it goes without saying, but one thing we need is leadership. We need leadership at the federal level and at the state level to make measurement and quality a high priority, because it's a federal-state program, so it's not just the feds, it's not just the states. And there's so many different things going on at the state level that it needs to be a priority. As I said earlier, we need a core set of measures, and by that I really mean core. I don't mean 50 measures. We have to figure out what are the most important measures to really measure the overall system and its impact on children. And those measures need to be done in collaboration, the feds with the states. States have a ton of experience in this area, and you can look at the documents in your packet, and there's a lot of examples of what states are doing. They have a lot of practical experience in terms of what is doable in this area of measurement. And that leads me to the third point, which is that states can't do it alone. There needs to be technical assistance and supports for states to foster innovation, to identify best practices, to put in place the mechanisms that are needed. And for that, they need funding to do that, again, because it has to be made a priority. And the last thing, and perhaps maybe the most important, is that if we're going to collect this data, we need to use it. We need to use the data for performance measurement. The worst thing that could happen is to have a set of measures, collect the data, and it sits over at the federal government and nobody looks at it. So that gets back to the point I made about really working with the states in developing these measures, because what you want to do is build on the data systems that states have already. build on what they're doing, incorporate that into the overall core set of measures, and develop something that states can really use to measure their performance in their system. Thank you. And I also wanted to, if I could, Nemours was one of the three sponsors of the health affairs issue. And I just, we did this with the California Endowment and with the Packard Foundation. And there's a lot of great articles in this. And there's a one-page summary that each of you have that is just hot off the press that we did to summarize the collection of articles. But I really recommend that you look at that health affairs journal. Thank you.
So you got to feel free. You have your choice of the one-page summary, which is actually a two-page summary, or the 609 pages of the journal itself. So you can, it's a good place to start. Thank you, Debbie. I neglected to do the logistical housekeeping chores that I usually do up front because we wanted to get to the presentations. But let me just remind you that the speakers who had slides have those slides in your packets available for you. They'll also be on our website, allhealth.org. If they're not already, they will be soon. You'll be able to watch a webcast of this briefing on kaisernetwork.org and see the materials on there electronically. You can even download a podcast for those of you who have nothing better to do on your metro ride in. Let me also just make a...
one more. If I could jump in, Ed, there's just, while he's going through that, there will be one more mechanism. We'll be making this into a Commonwealth Fund e-forum, which if you prefer not to watch us live, you can actually click through and you'll hear the speakers' voices, but you can actually advance to the slides or the presentation you want, and that'll be ready in a couple of weeks.
And it's virtually very... easy to follow. It's a good way to do it. Thank you, Ann. And more immediately, if you would pull out those blue evaluation forms and prepare to fill them out as we go along, we'll try to make improvements to these programs as we go along. You'll also find the green question cards. I know that'll shock those of you who have been here before. You can fill a question, you can write a question down, hold it up, and someone will bring it forward. There are also some microphones that you can use to ask a question in person, and I happen to have an advance submitted question to get us started, if I can. And it actually relates to some of the things that Sarah said and indirectly to what Nina was saying as well. The question is, how does benefit adequacy square with the idea of making it easier to subsidize kids on parents' employer coverage using SCHIP dollars? And I guess I would add to that, how do you address the complaints that we've heard in other forums from people dealing with this at the state level? That trying to do that, to integrate the two coverages, is incredibly difficult and burdensome.
Why don't I start and turn it over to Nina? The issue of essentially coordination of benefits is extremely difficult. Medicaid actually makes life a little bit easier for people because you can have dual coverage. You can have an employer plan, which you are bought into, and then you can supplement it. And, of course, that is what Senator Grassley has now codified as formal policy. It works a little bit different from the old coordination of benefits provisions, but it's his bill that set this as formal policy for moderate-income underinsured children with disabilities. SHIP is very, very difficult because... at least in my view, for looking at this from an operational point of view, when you run it as a separate program, because, of course, for the reasons that Nina alluded to, SHIP has anti-crowdout provisions built in. So you essentially can go one route or the other route, but you cannot buy a child a group benefit plan and then, for example, provide a dental benefit or vision care benefits, things that might not be in the group plan, but that a low-income family would need primary financing assistance to get, or, for example, a child like the Senator Grassley child with some employer coverage and then supplementation. So SHIP really, when separately administered, is set up to run as a means of getting a child into the market with the market strengths and limitations. Medicaid is actually more flexible in that you can use it to get a child into the market, but you can also supplement.
I would just add that the idea behind the whole concept of, or why I talk a lot about trying to push ideas like premium assistance and other models, is that it gives parents choices. Today, it seems like our entire healthcare system is based on, are you eligible for this program, you get put in this bucket. If you're eligible for this, you're put in that bucket. There's no integration between the various approaches to providing health care coverage. And by using a premium assistance model, you really can empower parents to decide, would I rather have my child with me in my employer policy? Would I rather buy a policy on my own in the market itself? I mean, it's not like it's prohibited for people to buying in the market itself. Or would you rather keep your child in SCHIP, which is more of a kind of government-controlled marketplace. And so I think that that's probably the most important feature, is how do you give parents and empower parents to make these choices instead of having these administrative hurdles that make the decisions for the parents.
Somebody had a microphone back there, or just someone reticent to come forward? Anne, you want to read a question from a card?
We've gotten the question, CDC recently released new prevalence rates on autism, noting that one in 150 children have autism. And the questions are, does SCHIP provide access to treatments for these kids, or is it some type of EPSDT supplement needed? And also, any estimates of the percentage of kids in SCHIP who may have significant needs that might need an EPSDT supplement? Sarah, do you want to start?
Sure. This is a variation on the question before, but this time focused on specifically the diagnosis of autism. If a state uses its SHIP funds to expand the Medicaid program, the EPSDT benefit is broad enough and flexible enough so that within allowable limits imposed by the federal government, a state can do a great deal to fashion the kinds of long-term care interventions that are needed by children with autism. For example, something at the level of a day clinic where a young child might go, if you walk in the door, it feels more like a nursery school, but it's actually a day clinical treatment program, very prevention-oriented, but aimed at a child who needs that special combination of therapeutic intervention to attain functioning. That's the whole point of EPSDT. It's an attainment program for children who may have developmental risks or actual diagnosed conditions that impair development. In the case of a separately administered SHIP program, there is absolutely no reason why a state cannot do the same thing with its allotment. The definition of child health assistance is actually about as broad in SHIP as it is in Medicaid. It's just that the custom in SHIP is to use the benefit very much the way Nina described, as premium support. So that the emphasis over the years has been on buying what is much more traditional commercial insurance-like benefit, or helping a family acquire what might be available through the employer, and not using it for children with significant long-term and chronic conditions. The reason I identified the DRA shift is because an important consideration for states, I think, in administering SHIP is whether, in fact, they want to use the new flexibility they're given to do more supplementation of a standard benchmark plan.
Debbie?
Yeah, let me just add to what Sarah was saying, that certainly there's flexibility in either in SCHIP or in Medicaid, certainly the private sector too, in terms of developing a package that would really meet the child's needs. But a key issue is having that screening and development tool, so you can identify early autism. And that's part of what I was talking about earlier in terms of needing a comprehensive, prevention-oriented set of benefits. I guess the third thing I was going to say is that, to answer the question more, I guess, literally, it really depends on what state you're in, whether how your services will be addressed. That's part of our federal state system right now for children's health. It's going to vary by state. But I guess the key is that the state does have the flexibility under SCHIP and under Medicaid to address these needs.
Turning perhaps to some of the issues that that Debbie, that you raised, that you ended with, a question here asks, where will the funds come from for the individual level data systems? And Jean, you may want to chime in as well. The questioner comments that states can't even report immunization rates broken out for SCHIP children. How can we go beyond the four existing performance measures to examine the content and the quality of care in SCHIP? And maybe, Debbie, you want to start with the kinds of measures, and Jean, you might want to comment a bit on the financing and others if they like.
Well, just a general comment. In terms of immunization, states have very good population-based data that look at immunization rates. And while it may be more difficult to track it by program type, at least when you look at the overall population, you get a good view of rates of immunizations by states. I think that certainly what I was talking about was the need for more investment by the federal government in terms of administrative costs to really build that infrastructure that's needed for data systems. And that's going to vary by the state and what's going on in a state, but there are several different needs. There's the need for IT. There's the need for funds for demonstration programs. So there's a variety of needs that are that would be critical in the development of this overall system. But some of it is, as I said earlier, leadership. It's making it a priority, getting the feds and key states together to develop a core set of measures. I mean, that could be done without a lot of funding, as long as there's the will to do it. So there are some parts of what I said that I think involve funding, and some parts that involve us making it a priority to have a high-performance system. And I really want to commend the Commonwealth for their work in really bringing attention to this, because some of it is funding and some of it is just making it a priority.
And I will say that we do have two options that we've used in the past to do this. One is states have up to 10% of their allotment that they could use on direct services, administrative costs, and other sorts of collections, and some states have used these funds for that. But we also, in the past, have used our matching rate for administrative costs to encourage investments in certain data areas. So we historically use a 90% federal matching rate to develop data systems for Medicaid and have done that for outreach in past periods. Right now, frankly, there's been an administration proposal to cut back on that for many of the administrative services that are out there that hopefully Congress won't consider, because the truth of the matter is that it's harder for states if Congress is cutting back or the administration is cutting back on administrative matching rates, but there's certainly options for doing so under the current systems.
And an additional option is perhaps in some of the Medicaid transformation grants. A number of the proposals are specific to some of the data systems. Again, I think that underscores Debbie's point, and I certainly agree with it, which is we have to have the will to want to make a high-performance system, and some of it isn't just funding, it's just priorities.
Yes,
a couple of things. On the House side, let's see, we've had two hearings and at least four briefings on SCHIP, and it is at the Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health's first priority. However, as you probably are all aware, we'll probably do something at the margins, and that's probably going to be what we do. But I'm hearing that there's a lot of will on this panel, at least, to do something more. So I guess my question is, in combining both the private sector and the public sector, I mean, we really, that's an enormous undertaking that's going to go well beyond the reauthorization limits for this year. So what do you suggest we do in reality? And then two, I guess on the data collection side, I just came back from the HIMSS conference, and there is a lot of will on the data collection side, and hopefully we'll incorporate that within the bills, at least on the House side, that we're going to get out this year?
I'll partly answer that excellent question by starting to say that, you know, I think that there's a challenge that you all face, which is we're going in the wrong direction, right? Currently, we have a declining number of uninsured and a declining baseline for children's health. So if you look at what Congressional Budget Office released recently, they were showing that, you know, today we're covering about, throughout the year, about 7.5 million people in SCHIP. But that's going to drop down to about 3.5 by the year 2017, without any changes. So I think the priority must be to at least maintain our existing programs and then go after this population who's eligible but unenrolled. I mean, when we started this program a decade ago, the goal was to significantly reduce the proportion and number of uninsured children who are low income, and certainly the program has done well at that, but has not finished the job. So in addition to maintaining our current services and getting at our target population, there is this question about what about the remaining children who are not eligible for the program today? I think we have proposals out there we'll be hearing more about. I think that we've heard that Senator Clinton and John Dingell are thinking about some sort of covering all kids proposal. Children's Defense Fund has been out there saying this is the year we should consider this. I do think we'll be seeing more activity and action around this issue. But I can only imagine that, you know, the ship has a first turn, which is finding the funding to maintain the existing program, then kind of target the children who are eligible and enrolled, and then hopefully if there is the will and the way, meaning the budget funding allocated towards this, we might see kind of that remaining increment in public policy.
Okay.
Yes, Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just echoing what Jean has said, I think the number one issue this year is the financing question. If you look at SHIP and its interaction with Medicaid, the options on the table once states have sufficient money to run with are not bad. I mean, we could always do things to improve the functioning of any program, SHIP or Medicaid, but the real crunch here is simply keeping a flow of funds going to states so that using their additional funding, either separately or in combination with Medicaid, depending on the circumstances of the state and the issues it chooses to target. If it wants to, you know, beef up primary prevention, it may dictate one kind of design approach. If a high priority is upgrading chronic illness and disability services, there may be another design approach. As Jean mentioned, you can do investments in infrastructure and quality reporting, even under current law. I think the big issue was the money.
Could I just follow up with a question on another card that raises sort of the next step and whether you ought to take it? How have SCHIP expansion programs to cover parents or other populations functioned? And what are the primary obstacles they've faced to effectively covering SCHIP families? How far do you want to go? Anybody?
I'll be happy. I mean, I think it gets back to what was discussed. It's all on financing and how, you know, what is the scope of the proposal? The discussion today, the vehicle is SCHIP, but I think it's also important, I was going to answer after you finish the first question, to not forget that there are other populations that are still uninsured. And while child's coverage and children's health insurance is important, it needs to be discussed in what we're doing in the broader context of overall health care reform. And I think that sometimes gets lost in the discussions of, well, we'll take care of this population, then we'll figure out another solution. But these solutions still, I mean, I think one of the problems we have is that they're very disjointed, and we need to find ways to fix the system as a whole so it's not dependent on just one program and say, here's SCHIP, here's a vehicle, we'll put everyone on this program. But really looking at what's wrong with the current system, why are these children uninsured, and what can we do to help encourage greater continuity and coverage for the long term?
And I would just add the fact that, you know, one of the things that we discovered in looking at children's health for the past 10 years is that when you cover parents, you're more likely to get the children enrolled. This kind of makes a lot of sense in terms of common sense, but the research has been backing this up. So we do know that participation rates are higher when parents are also eligible. Some states have done this, some states haven't. But we can't forget that the median income eligibility level for our parents is well below the poverty threshold, whereas we have most states, not all states, at 200% of poverty for children. So we have to remember we have this big disconnect between children and parents today. But I will note that, you know, there is, and this is going to be an issue this year because people are concerned about the so-called crowd-out effect, which is if you extend access to parents, will you be crowding out private insurance? And I do think it's important just to review what we know about that topic. The federal evaluation that Congress sponsored on the state children's health insurance program said, quote, the program did not lead to widespread substitution of SCHIP for employer coverage, even though almost all families enrolling their children had at least one working parent. We also know from some studies that the Urban Institute did that only about a third of kids who are in CHIP have a parent who has employer-based coverage. Only 10% of children in Medicaid have a parent who has employer-based coverage. So we do see these disconnects. I think the last important thing to remember is that when we actually look at children enrolled in the program, we know that most of them are coming from being uninsured, about 43% according to the federal evaluation. 29% are coming from Medicaid, so their parents earn more income, which in previous history would have meant that they were ineligible for program participation. But 29% of kids are moving from Medicaid into SCHIP as their parents are earning more money. And only about 28% of children enrolling in CHIP had previously had private insurance, with about half of them having lost coverage through their employer system before they got into the program. So I do think that we have to keep an eye on this crowd-out issue because you're going to be hearing a lot about it this year. I think that most of our evidence shows that it's not a major problem in SCHIP.
Got a question that's initially directed anyway to Nina. With respect to premium subsidies, do you have a position on how best to administer such a program? It's kind of an echo of what we were talking about before. That is, through state social service agencies or through tax credits or some other means.
Well, I think there are a variety of ways of administering one. I think that's probably the second tier issue. I think if you look at just children, that already is a combined federal, this is just one example, combined federal-state program. So you have federal dollars involved, you have state dollars involved. But ideas of fixing, you know, tax credits, utilizing tax credits possibly for the parents could be an option of looking at how do we encourage the parents to obtain private coverage in the private market, especially if they're uninsured and their children are uninsured. How do we move away from simply enrolling them all into SCHIP? We hear a lot about we should just enroll the eligible, but enroll them into the program. But I think the alternative is what are the other options? And I think tax policy, such as tax credits, a refundable, advanceable, assignable tax credit. So that means even the lower income people get the full credit. It's simply a system of delivering the subsidy. Could be a good starting point, especially when we're looking at these populations. We have to remember that there's a distinction. We can't just bulge everyone into one group and saying children or low-income children. I mean, a lot of these states are already at 300% of poverty. Those are, you know, $60,000 or more families' household. And so what do we do in the policy-wise of designing subsidies that may more effectively address the needs of that population? For example, allowing them to use funding through subsidies through SCHIP or a tax proposal in order to provide private health insurance.
In Maryland, we had implemented a premium assistance program, and as been mentioned by many of the panelists, it really involves a coordination of benefits. So to implement this, you need to take into account that there needs to be a coordinating entity that coordinates the benefits, because it's very complicated. So I think more than if you had it with tax credits, you'd still have to have some type of entity that's actually coordinating the benefits, because you're coordinating your federal, your state, and then your private benefits. So whatever you do in this area in terms of implementing it, you do have to get to that second tier that focuses on how you actually can most effectively coordinate the benefits.
Just to add on to that and then jump into another question, I mean, most states have found it very difficult to do administratively for the number of children that they insure, which is why they haven't gone that route. But there may be some obstacles in the way it's designed, and changes in those would make it easier. But let me also jump in a question that's related to what we were talking about, is that talking about options for low-income working families, aren't there lower offer rates for many of the low-income workers? And a second question is that, we've talked about access to comprehensive benefits being necessary for kids, but many of the private benefits, or the question was asked, how do these benefits compare to medically necessary care that get provided under the EPST benefit? In other words, that is a richer benefit than is found in most employer coverage, especially that for low-income workers. So the person wanted, I guess they asked, how do these two compare?
Let Jean start with the offer.
Well, yeah, okay, we'll divide up the answer, which is on the employer issue, without a doubt, low-income people have less access to employer-based insurance. And I think it's important to put this in the bigger context. We have seen a significant erosion in the percentage of employers offering coverage and the percentage of workers getting coverage through their workplace. But it's also important to recognize that even among lower income workers, those who have access to it tend to participate. I mean, it really is not that there's a bunch of people out there who have access to it who are not necessarily paying it. The vast majority of people who have access to employer-based coverage across the income spectrum participate when given that access. We're generally talking about people who don't really have the option. So it does become like a needle in the haystack trying to figure out who are those families who have that access but can't afford it, and then how do we help them. I would note that there are two different models out there for how you could help these types of people in that caught in that nexus. One is like what the state of Maine did, which is trying to create a purchasing pool where Medicaid and SCHIP are buying people into this purchasing pool for small businesses, and small businesses are independently buying into it, and you merge the money that way. It kind of alleviates this coordination of benefits issue. And some states have proposed to allow employers as well as families to buy into SCHIP because, as Sarah mentioned earlier, these are basically private insurance plans offering kind of benefits that are typically private insurance benefits with a state subsidy. So it's not like it's inimical to kind of a private sector model. So we have two different models, or three models. One is classic premium support, try to keep the kid in the employer-based coverage plan. Two is like Maine, where you try to create a purchasing pool and subsidize that. And third is just simply allowing the employers to buy into a state-based SCHIP plan. And that's kind of, these are all ways that you could all simplify and coordinate this coverage.
With respect to the benefits, I think here's the easiest way to think about it. When you buy a private plan, whether you're buying it through the employer-sponsored group market or the individual market or a third way, a group market that is created, but that is to function as a group insurance market, you're buying insurance. So you're buying what insurance is, and insurance is a risk contract. And so the structure of a risk contract looks nothing like the structure of Medicaid, particularly for children. It's a much narrower set of benefit classes. A lot of benefit classes that you would find in Medicaid don't exist in a risk contract world. There are a lot more exclusions, either by the diagnosis or by some other attribute of the person holding the policy or the setting of care. For example, no care in the home, no care in a school setting. There's a lot more cost sharing, obviously. Even when it's controlled, it's going to be more than one would typically find in Medicaid, at least traditionally. And there is a much narrower definition of medical necessity. So when you're insuring a child or covering a child through Medicaid, even if you take a portion of that financing and go out, as most states do now, and buy an insurance-like product, they buy a managed care enrollment. Here in D.C., we have, 100,000 children enrolled with a commercially designed managed care plan. But what state Medicaid programs do is essentially supplement that enrollment, number one, with the low prevalence, high cost services, and number two, the enrollment agreements actually have modifications in them that have them depart from standard commercials. So, for example, here in D.C., the contract has a full developmental assessment, provides a lot of the services that are associated with EPSDT, and says to the marketer, when you sell this product, we want you to add some services in that you don't normally sell to an employer group. So that's sort of the compromise.
Okay. Well, there's a question in this one. The person makes the observation that the IOM insurance reports point to the stability of coverage as extremely important for children and families. There are now counter-cyclical provisions being considered as part of the SCHIP reauthorization that will encourage states to maintain SCHIP coverage during a recession. I guess that's a question. I know the answer to that question is yes, but the exact nature of them, what they are, what they should be, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, I'd very much like to hear from the panel.
I'll take a quick shot at this, and I think Debbie might have some more to add, which is, you know, if we try to figure out about how do we actually ensure that we get those eligible but unenrolled kids, and then how do we kind of keep those children, there is lots of good research that shows that a few things do work. Number one is trying to have longer periods of eligibility. We don't see that much income instability in this population, so doing continuous eligibility for a year works, according to most of our studies. We also know that making the eligibility process on the way in, as well as redetermination, is an important phenomenon, because if we look at what we call disenrollment surveys, what happens after children leave, the federal evaluation found that only 14% gain private coverage, about 34% lose income and go back to Medicaid eligibility, and 48% of children leaving SCHIP become uninsured, which is very distressing. So we know that continuous eligibility, simple eligibility and redetermination matter, but also importantly, some of the rules that Congress has imposed are a problem. We saw in the New York Times today an article about citizenship documentation, in which states are being required to use certain types of forms, like actual birth certificates with raised seals, to have families prove that their child or their individuals are citizens. And these eligibility rules are having major dampening effects on outreach and enrollment efforts for legal immigrants, undocumented children, as well as citizens of the U.S. And these are the sorts of barriers that, if we're really serious about trying to get continuous eligibility in the program, keeping those children eligible, we have to readdress.
I would only just add one other one. I do want to underscore that making the redetermination processes as simple as possible, and presuming somebody is eligible rather than not eligible. But the other one is self-declaration of income. Those kinds of things states have also been doing. I mean, one of the great things about SCHIP was that over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of innovation from the states in terms of, you know, what works in terms of continuous eligibility and redetermination and the eligibility process. So there's a lot of best practices, and Jean identified some of them. I've identified some of them that really, really help to ensure that the child is enrolled for longer periods of time, which will then help during the counter-cyclical periods.
Nina?
I just want to add a little bit to that as well. Having eligibility enrollment for a program is fine, but at some point you're still going to have the effect of going into private coverage, and then yet again you're losing the continuity of coverage. Now, some can argue that, well, that we need to have a single kind of single-payer, government-run healthcare system. But I think that there also is an argument of saying, what about empowering people to hold and maintain private coverage on their lifetime? So you're not worried about whether the employer is offering the right kind of coverage or whether the market is actually agreeing with me. I think a lot of the problems we see in the individual market in particular and what policies are being offered, although they are comprehensive, I think it's important to note that it's because these people are in the market temporarily. There are very few people who buy insurance policies for healthcare as they do with other types of policy, like life insurance, where it's a whole life. You buy something, you're going to stay with that plan. or even in the car insurance market, which is different, but the same mentality that you're saying, I'm going to stay with this insurance company. Now, they have an investment in me. It's not the investment in the government. It's not an investment in the employer themselves, but it's an investment in me to say, if I have a child who's five and who has a developmental disability, that insurance plan, if I have a contract with them, has incentive to screen and get that care done early instead of waiting until things are way out of control. The same thing can be done on diseases and obesity in particular. Having children and saying, you know, if you're a diabetic, if you know that diabetes is going to hit this child soon because of obesity and other issues, then it creates a different dynamic, which we're not seeing today. But I think in the future, we can look at a little bit differently instead of saying, how do we get more people in one program as children, and what do we do when that child's family earns, you know, another 10% more in income? And I think we need to look at broader health care reform and how do we give individuals greater control over their health insurance instead of just waiting to see what bucket they'll fall into.
Okay. I have a, I guess it's a comment on a card. It's listed on a question card, but it, if I summarize correctly, I think I can do this without having to ask a question. The person in response to Nina's citing of Jonathan Gruber's study about crowd out notes that the Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health has a communication from John Gruber pointing out that the estimates of crowd out for families under 200% of the poverty line are lower, and I can't tell from the way this is worded what the citation for that lower rate is, but I commend to you both his original testimony and his study and the letter dated apparently March 1 to make sure that we're citing that figure in the correct way. So there is that. And Ann, you want to...
Well, we also did get some questions about how we can improve dental care for low-income kids, and I'm sure that that's a big problem. I'm not sure that that's the expertise of our panel,
well,
but if
some of it's coverage, just
in terms of getting even the providers.
Well,
in.
Yes, I'm sure there's nobody in this area who missed the terrible story from a couple of weeks ago now about the child who died in suburban Washington because Medicaid had lapsed, lost the coverage, was homeless, and could not find a dentist in any event to deal with the child's teeth. Clearly, a starting point is the coverage. Most states, even in a separately administered SHIP situation, are providing at least some dental coverage. Medicaid, of course, mandates dental coverage, very broad dental coverage for children, but the huge issue in dental care for children is not just the financing, it's the access to care. There are have been a lot of efforts over the years to try and deal with this. Some of the most effective, quite frankly, are less those that rely on incentivization of the private market and much more deliberate interventions where, for example, a community health center will partner with a teaching program, Columbia Dental program has a wonderful partnership with the city's community health centers in New York, and they have gotten dental care out into many neighborhoods. There is a large dental program in Colorado that serves thousands of people. There is a program in northern Wisconsin that is bringing people from Milwaukee, 3-hour bus trips paid for by the Medicaid program, to get publicly operated dental services. One of the I think most important things that will happen around dentistry is the reauthorization of the National Health Service Corps and community health centers. That's really, aside from just the expansion of the financing, where Congress, I think, as a policy matter, can make a huge difference. That and teaching, not getting rid of the teaching component in Medicaid payments for hospitals, where actually a lot of dental residents are trained as well.
I was just going to make a point about the workforce issues. It's also, as Sarah ended with, it's also a huge workforce issue in trying to get people trained who will go into areas where vulnerable children are to serve them. That's a huge issue as well.
Let me We're just about out of time and steam up here, and I'm going to ask our panelists to offer a final comment if they would like. And as I give them a chance to adjust to that unforeseen request, let me take that time to ask you to make a few final remarks as well on the blue evaluation form as we come to the close of the program here. Why don't we start with Sarah?
Okay. I think I've made all the remarks I need to make. I would just note that the issue of what we pay for children is as important as do we cover them at all. If we are not mindful of the kinds of issues that Debbie raised, the kinds of issues that we deal with in benefit design, we can end up with a situation in which children are ostensibly covered. But that the coverage is really not aligned with what we know about children's growth and development and their health care needs going from preventive all the way to long-term.
And because I was speaking about financing, I'll just say that financing matters. I mean, if we think about what have people complained about with SCHIP in the last decade, what has Congress changed, and there's only one thing, and that is the financing formulas and how we pay for this program. We need to obviously fix that, but I think we also have to recognize that, you know, if we keep the current structure, we may be seeing these same types of challenges over the next decade, especially if we're saying to states, find and enroll those eligible but uninsured kids. I hope that this Congress considers new ideas for how we can actually share financial responsibility at the federal level with states that do successful outreach, be it through some sort of, you know, enrollment adjustment has been proposed by some people, hold harmlesses so that the state is not held liable for any costs that are above the allotment due to outreach. Other types of mechanisms I hope will be considered in this Congress so we don't spend our next 10 years doing what we've done in the past 10 years. And I will say lastly, I know that it sounds like it's all new spending, but it's not like there aren't necessarily ways to pay for this. Senator Smith has talked about a tobacco tax as one source of financing. Congressional Budget Office has done its deficit reduction book, which has a myriad of health savings, including potential Medicare HMO overpayments, which I think have been spent 10 times over and will be difficult to get anyway. But there are options out there, and I do hope that this Congress really does look hard at that because money does matter.
I just want to stress the part on the title of the program, the Beyond SCHIP, because I think there are more options for thinking about how to cover children beyond the context of the box of SCHIP that we have today, and that policymakers should really explore those types of alternatives that really promote continuity in care for the lifetime of a child, not simply just looking at how to get them into a program itself and simply checking a box and saying, yes, this child is now enrolled in a program. And I would also like to stress that the private sector does offer alternatives and is a good place to look to see what can we do to actually improve quality and care that is being delivered in the private market itself instead of simply just saying, well, we'll just focus on SCHIP itself. There's a lot of lessons in the private market that can also be integrated not only into SCHIP but as a stepping stone to private coverage for all children.
My final comments are that, SCHIP and coverage is a critical step. It's a critical first step, and that we really need to think beyond that and think about our child health system and developing a system that really addresses the needs of children over time. And also on the issue of performance measurement and quality, that really be a joint effort between the states and the federal government in terms of developing that system. States have a lot of experience in this area, and as we know from Medicaid and from SCHIP, there's been a lot of innovation and there's a lot happening at the state level in the area of quality, and that we really need to build off of what's already happening when we think about this system.
Ann?
I guess I would just like to emphasize that although there has been some disagreement about what directions we might go, there's a great deal of agreement across this panel here that it is critical that we cover children and we cover them early and we get them the services that they need. The comments about broader reform I'd also like to underscore, which is not only do we need to provide quality coverage, but we do need to look at improving the quality of care and the efficiency in delivery. There is money in the system. We need more of it, but there is money in the system if we would improve those aspects, which is why you saw that chart that Debbie used, that our commission is looking simultaneously at coverage, efficiency, and quality, and part of the key is there. And my very final thing is, as Jean put it, financing matters, but when you think about the costs of covering kids, they are really low in comparison to so many other things we are spending. Even a $50 billion shortfall is a very small amount of money compared with other priorities, and we need to think about them in that context. So we're pleased to have made those points.
Very good. Thank you, Anne. Let me just also add, in thinking about broader contexts for these reforms, that you all should be in putting on your calendar the program scheduled for next Monday. In partnership with the Commonwealth Fund, the Alliance will be holding a briefing looking at broader ways to broaden coverage, everything from the President's proposals to promote coverage more in an individual market to Medicare for all, and lots of stuff in between. So mark your calendars, respond to the email when you get back. Let me just also say to reiterate the thanks to John Iglehart and Project Hope and the folks at Health Affairs for making sure that we have the text for this discussion and for your study over the next couple of weeks. Thanks again to the Commonwealth Fund for the active participation of Anne and her staff at the fund, and for their support and co-sponsorship of the event, and ask you to join me in thanking the panel for an excellent exposition of some very difficult issues.